Welcome to the Jimbo and Jeff podcast.
Never have you known such cringing terror.
The Jimbo and Jeff podcast.
Now, here's Jimbo and Jeff.
Hello.
Hello.
Jimbo and Jeff.
Dum, 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 dum.
Oh, wow.
He is alive.
Oh, look at that. He's got kind of the lighting. You know, he's got the cool.
Look at that. What the What are we doing, Jeff? We don't have books behind us like, you know, all of our guests.
Oh, look at that. Oh, wow. He's got a... Look at this.
Look at that chair.
My gaming chair.
He's got a gaming chair.
Wow. But I don't game. God, if I only had time to game.
Does that go to 0 to 60 in 3 seconds?
Yeah, it goes backwards. 0 to minus to 60.
But do you have like 4 monitors on your desk?
No, I wish. Actually, I am returning from the U.S. has been, I have to say, I enjoyed the lack of technology that is part of my life right now. I miss it terribly, but it's impossible to get that kind of connectivity here just yet. So I'm working out, for the most part, with a very old laptop that I carry throughout the house. And this is my office. It's really hard to move this around, but I have my old desk, which is, you know, I just got it.
Oh,
really happy. My lava lamp. That's actually a wedding present from Pee Wee Herman. So that came all the way from LA through New York and to here. And then all the books, all the cookbooks.
Yeah.
Okay. TV timeout. TV timeout. I want to hear the story on the Pee Wee Herman gift.
First of all, are you already recording?
Of course we are. Come on, I'm in broadcasting. We never stop recording.
Oh, right on. Okay. All right, let me mute in case the wife calls.
we'll put her on, too.
Or my mother these days.
Oh, we'll put mom on as well.
We're going to talk about that.
You don't want to. Oh, my gosh. What happened?
Yeah. Well, hey, ladies and gentlemen, we want to welcome our next guest. This is really special for me because I understand him really more than most people know, because I lived in Italy for a number of years, not as long as he has, but it's really kind of fun to have him. He's an Italian celebrity chef. He's an entrepreneur, television personality. He's married to Debbie Marzer, a famous actress with 2 beautiful daughters. He's the creator and producer of Extra Virgin on the Cooking Channel, which incidentally won the James Beard TV Award for in-studio or fixed location. Also been the author of the best-selling cookbook of the same name, which I have, Extra Virgin, hello, which he did sign for me.
I hope you're putting it to good use.
Actually, I am. You know me. I love to cook, so.
I know.
So he was very gracious to do that. He owned a really great place in Brooklyn called the Tuscan Gun, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And they also starred, he and Debbie also starred in another show called Extra Virgin Americana, back in 2016 as well. He was also really instrumental in some amazing charities. He was a council member of the Food Bank in New York City. You need to put a big Jimbo and Jeff hand together for Gabriele Corco.
And for you and for everybody connecting. Applause to all of us. Gotta kind of like cheer everybody up.
Yeah, we need that. Hey, how are you in Italy today?
First of all, question: can I curse when I talk? Are we rated, or I just don't want to.
You can, like, you can, but only wrong. In Italian.
So only in Italian, okay. Cazzo, yeah. Which is not bad.
That was good, Jimbo. I was just gonna say it doesn't matter. I'll just check the box when I put this together.
It is beautiful here. It is beautiful, even if we are going through obviously a serious lockdown moment. I haven't been in my city. I've been in the city once in the past 3 weeks. People here take it extremely seriously. You get the ordinance coming from Rome and Italy shuts down. People are not happy about it, but you know, we're going through it. There won't be any restaurants open between Christmas and New Year's. So there won't be any ski resorts open throughout the winter. Thank God I'm moving to the country. So I have so much work to do here at the farm that I'm just keeping busy regardless. But it's tough times. And I also have 2, you know, teenage daughters that are doing remote learning, one from college in Buffalo where she was supposed to be, and the college shut down, you know, they just closed in her face, the dorms. And then the other one started high school here, started making friends. The moment she started making friends, the school closed down, and my wife is not here. She's in New York filming right now. So I'm fixing the house, taking care of the kids, working a bit, thankfully. You know, I'm lucky enough to be working. But yeah, not the easiest time. I am happy regardless. This is, 20 years in the making, the dream of coming home. I wish it happened with my wife, but she'll come.
Now, tell us the city name. Is it Fiesole?
Fiesole. Fiesole. Fiesole is a very small, quaint town on the hills on the north side of Florence. So we have an unobstructed view of the whole valley, the Duomo and stuff. I am a little behind the hills, so I don't see the city straight up. I see only the northern side where the valley of the river just keeps moving. I see the lights of the city, but I live in the country. And it's probably, I would say, the closest real country village to Florence without a real commuting distance. Like if you go to the Chianti area, you have to drive, you know, it's more famous than Fiesole for certain things, but you got to drive 45 minutes. We are about 15 minutes, 10 minutes if you're on a motorcycle from the city. So it's, we're really well connected, and it's nice. It's very, very nice.
I am familiar with Figline Valdarno, which is south of town. Our friends have a little agriturismo down there, and that's where we. As a matter of fact, today it's our anniversary, and we always order.
Oh, happy anniversary, man!
Thank you very much. 15 liters of olive oil coming from Il Palagio, being delivered today.
Fantastic! That's really good.
So I am waiting for you to start selling your own olive oil. I need a new supplier.
I got here a little late in the game to wedge myself into the process. You know, the process is taking, it's not complicated, but it's taken very seriously, and you just cannot be the one that just arrives at the last minute. But I got the okay from the family to be the one that as of the end of this harvest and this press. So, you know, by January, February, I'll start being the one following, you know, in the name of the family, what happens to the land, which I'm excited. Even if we don't have the means to build our own farm, it is not a real sound investment these days. There are plenty of places that press olive oil around us. So it's a matter of, you know, alliances and contracts and finding the right person that can help you bottle it, do it right, and maybe help you ship it. I would love to design a label that is for the American market. You know, people have been asking for a very long time, and it's something that I would love to do.
How many hectares do you have there?
It's about 70 hectares, so it's about 18,000 plants. It's a lot. It's a lot of olive oil. That's why, again, you know, my great-grandfather was the one running the farm. The moment that the farmers started leaving and the people started getting old, all the land was given as a license to a much bigger farm that is a neighbor farm. They maintain it, they harvest, they press it. They pay us a licensing fee, and then they just make a business out of whatever they can sell. It's just it is not a real commodity, olive oil. You know what I mean? It is about the passion. It's really not about the profit that you can make out of it. One of the things that I've learned in the U.S. is actually there are people that do appreciate real good olive oil, but the olive oil market is a little blurry because Americans tend to use seed oil a little more, butter a little more. And it's also hard to justify the expense of an olive oil that is really of prime quality for about 6 months. So if you want to enjoy it the right way, you got to pay the shipping, which adds a lot to your premium price. So what, you know, an eighth of a gallon is going to cost you $40. There is the market in the big cities, New York, Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, but the average American market, it is not an olive oil market. So if I do it, I do it to keep my farm alive, to keep the trees healthy. It's an excuse to have that income that keeps the land alive.
Well, I, for one, am very excited this morning because I have no ties to Italy and I've never met you. However,
go to Italy, dude. That's what we got to do.
So I was doing my little research here and my sister-in-law was in town. And she said, well, who's on the Jimbo and Jeff podcast? And I told her, and she, oh my gosh, I love him. I'm like, okay. And so last night we're sitting at the table and I tell my wife, hey, hey, didn't you go to Italy? She goes, oh, yeah, I traveled all over. And I said, well, where did you go? And she said, here's what she told me. She said, I lived in Milan a long time. Rome, Verona, Venice, Florence. Does that all ring a bell? Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, all of them. Absolutely.
And then she goes, I'm a girl that went through Italy and ate all the ice cream. And I go, I thought you said it was gelato. She goes, it's gelato. It's gelato.
Yeah. There's a difference in creaminess. So the difference is making in America, everybody says ice cream, even when they refer to gelato. When Italians talk about ice cream, they think it's the same thing. Americans tend to use a little bit more heavy cream. It's a little richer. It's a little more constructed. Italians is a little lighter, a little fluffier. There's a little bit more air in the mix. My dog is barking like damn crazy, and I don't know what's going on. I really hope that I don't have to pick up the phone for my daughters or something. I apologize.
No problem.
Oh, it's okay. It's all good.
We're dog people.
Right on.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was her question. You know, what is the main difference? She had two questions for her. One, what's the main difference between gelato and ice cream? And then two, can you deliver? We'd like to order some of this stuff from you.
Oh, well, I wish it was easy to ship ice cream or gelato from Italy. I don't see it happening. I have to say, though, my favorite, you know, I have a sweet tooth, but it's really more like the junky sweet tooth. Like my sweet tooth is like the munchies at midnight when I'm dipping a whole bag of cookies in a glass of milk. That's kind of like, or pastries in the morning. In general, my two favorite ice creams in New York City are either Vivoli, which is the cease that was opened by a Florentine lady that has an ice cream shop in the center of Florence. And it's actually at Macy's in the city, which I don't know if it's open or closed right now. And the other one is Big A Ice Cream. Big A Ice Cream is the best ice cream truck in town. And I like the playfulness. It's really not even about the, you know, their ice cream is, you know, the white or the chocolate with all the different toppings on top. I am not a topping kind of person. I like to have the different tastes and the flavor, you know, the fruit, the chocolate, the dairy. But they do, you know, a fantastic job. So kudos to them.
When Peggy and I were in Italy for our anniversary, our 30th anniversary 3 years ago, we were in Lecce down in the heel of Italy. And my good friend, Mike Quinn, who immigrated to your country, he retired. He was a friend of mine from here in Austin. And he said, screw it, I'm out. He sold everything except his $5,000 rocket espresso machine and his...
That's how we do it. Yes.
And I have one of those too. I just got one recently. But also, he took us out when we were there and we had pistachio gelato.
That's the story of the house. So this is the house where I grew up, right? And when I met Deborah, we started fixing a little barn that belonged to the house where, like, it was a god job, like everything to be redone from the sewage to, you know, an old 15th century barn that has never been used. And we started little by little by little. And then in the process, my father passed about 3 years ago. And my mother, a couple of years later, came to me and was like, look, I know that you're trying to fix that little barn, but the house where you grew up is now too big for me. Everything reminds me of your father. I just can't. I would love to size down, move someplace else. And if you really want to start thinking about eventually one day coming back, you can take this one. And that really was the moment where me and David were like, okay, so now we don't have to save this enormous amount of money before we consider going home. We can make it happen because the house has the heat, has good plumbing. I mean, you know, it's 34 years old, but quite different than, you know, 100 years old. And we made it. We did it. We decided about a year and a half ago. So this is not a pandemic choice. There's nothing to do with the elections or the way that United States, no, I love United States. I already miss terribly the United States, but I was just missing home more. And I'll be back. I'm way too American to, I'm not Italian that way. You know, I'm ambitious. I want to do things. There are so many things in life that I want to do, but I needed to come here to start working on my dream, on my personal dream, which is the house where I know that I grew old with Deborah, you know, God wants. And something to leave my kids. My kids, which one started college, one started high school, within 4 years, I'll be an empty nester, really. By then, the house will be ready. And God knows, maybe I'll be in Manhattan again. I have absolutely no clue. But my wife is filming in New York. She was supposed to film between March and July last, you know, this past spring, summer.
Right.
Everything got pushed. And we were supposed to be here now together. My daughter was supposed to be in Buffalo, and everything, like all our lives, they got a little scrambled up. So I'm going to be without her until February, which is, you know, thank God I have tons of work to do. And hopefully, you know, by February when we're back together, and you know, we'll start maybe, you know, we're considering doing something else again from here, the way that we did our show in the past few years for the Cooking Channel. So that's something that I'm working towards, you know, fixing the house, getting it ready for it. We have Wi-Fi now, which is great.
Yeah, I saw your post where you were gonna put up your dish to get some connectivity. Oh, get that up.
This is fantastic. Far from what I was used to. I mean, New York connection is insanely fast.
Right.
I love that, every moment of it. But I also like the fact that my life is a little bit more disconnected right now. You know, my social media work is always there. I still engage on behalf of, you know, myself or clients, and I do that kind of stuff. But the hyper connectivity, that binge watching doesn't exist, like downloading a whole series of, like, I have barely the time to watch some news at night to know if I'm allowed to go to the city or not the day after. So that's kind of like how it is at this point. Cold is coming. It's been kind of like wonderful weather until last week, and now finally it's kind of like, you know, tightening a bit. I was able to get a financing for a car after 6 months of trying. August to now, what is it? Yeah, about 5 months. Right. Took me 5 months to get financing because I you know, I wasn't a resident here. Right. Even if I'm Italian, nobody knows me. So it took me a while to find someone who's like, all right, we'll give you the money.
Okay. Did you ship your Ducati back from the state?
No, man. Oh, just let's not talk about it.
Please. Oh,
no. I couldn't. I modified my motorcycles too much to be re-registered here. America has very, very loose rules when it comes to, you know, buy a bike and do whatever you want with it. Here, you know, they just arrest you right away. Not arrest you, but they seize your vehicle if it doesn't conform. So anything that I've done to my bikes made them unregisterable in Italy, and I really didn't want to go through the whole thing. So I sold the three. One is still in New York City waiting for a client to grab it. And then once that is done, then, you know, in January, I'm starting to renovate my garage. And once the garage is ready, then
all right,
start shopping for bikes.
I need to share this. There he is. He's one of those Italians that,
oh my God.
But he's dressed
that's
up in leather.
That's for sale in New York. That's the one for sale in New York City right now.
Is it really?
Yeah, her name is Tosca. She's fantastic.
Oh,
yeah.
Look, he's all in his leathers. This is, I lived in Italy. This is how people dress when they're on their, you know, even on their Vespas, yeah. For God's sakes.
Oh, yeah. That's normal, man. I'm so happy that I can finally wear my leather again. I sound like a muscle queen, but no, I want to wear my tight leathers again.
Denim and leather.
One of the things that I'm doing now that I'm in Tuscany, I'm trying to help local producers and small farmers and mid-sized companies that have lost basically any form of income. This farm is right on the hills, like you're facing south, right? You have right. The sunset on the right. This is the valley that goes all the way down into Rome. And they have either rooms that are empty, and they sell wine to people that come from all the different hotels in the area to bring them back, mostly to America. So their business is virtually dead right now. So what I'm doing is that I'm visiting all my friends and all these farms and trying to get them online to do some sort of like a Toscan QVC moment where we create discount codes and invite people to do certain kind of like, you know, important purchases just to keep them alive. And it's working out nice. I'm happy to be able to be here to provide that kind of service because they desperately need it. And their wines actually, and their olive oil is absolutely fantastic. So I got to visit a couple of times, and it's a very nice place, the Fattoria Santa Piano. Should kind of like check it out and go see it.
Right. You know what I like is in during this time of year in Italy, looking at this valley here, when you're up on the hill and it's cold in the morning and it's kind of frosty, there's this layer of fog that kind of builds in the valleys.
Yes.
That is just so hard to describe, and until you see it yourself, is just amazing. That's why I love Italy so much.
You know, it's One of the things that I missed the most when I was in the US were the moments that I usually dedicated just to myself, of pausing for a moment and looking around and really, you know, taking it in. And it's funny because since I've been back, every sunset, every sunrise, every cloud that passes over the house and in the valley, whenever I'm with my brother, I'm like, oh my God, look how beautiful. And my brother's like, bro, like it's every day. It's just how it is. I missed it for such a long time that right now I do have this renewed appreciation for the things that I'm regaining. So to me, it feels like a gigantic gift, actually, to be back here. And I owe a lot to my wife, who had the courage to make that choice, because, you know, I'm sure that, hey, look at her.
Hey, Bella.
How do you call the people from Austin? Austinians?
Austinites.
Austinites.
Austinites. Austinites, I miss you.
Well, you can come back anytime. We'll treat you to some really good barbecue.
Right on. I don't know if I have something. Well, I do have all my, you know, collection of cookbooks that I bought in Austin.
Oh, yeah.
I have a whole section dedicated to your town. Three, four books.
Well, if you would, let's back up. We'd love to know the story. How did you meet Debbie? And kind of that whirlwind story. Tell us about that.
Oh, it was weird. I mean, it was weird. It was really like a pure coincidence. I was co-producing a record. There was a famous piano player that lived in Florence at the time. Her name is Katia Labeck. Katia and her sister are two very famous classical piano players here in Europe and in the US as well. And on that summer, she was recording an album with Sting. They were getting ready to prepare a concert to bring to Pompeii down in Naples and have a big festival during the summertime. So I was there producing the whole rhythm section. There was a drummer from New York, a percussionist, a Cuban percussionist that came from Switzerland. And me, as a drummer, a percussionist, I was there, like, you know, running all that side. Deborah was piggybacking on Madonna's tour, who started at that time in Spain. And she was kind of like traveling with her as a girlfriend, using their airfare rates and their hotel rates, kind of like traveling at a discount, basically. When she arrived in Europe, she talked to my boss, who was in Florence, and they met at Madonna's wedding years prior. And she's like, Debbie, come down. I'm recording an album. I have my house full of artists. Come down to Florence. And so Deborah came down to Florence. We met in that house. On the night that we met, she arrived in an afternoon, late afternoon. The night we had, you know, at the end of the recording sessions, we had a beautiful dinner. She would cater every single night in this loggia that was like wonderful. And I finished my cigarettes, you know, really Italian thing. So I told Deborah, hey, look, you know, you want to come to the square? I'll show you the square, buy cigarettes, come back. She's like, yeah, sure, let's do it. We got out, we ended up buying drinks. We sat on the stoop of the church. Spent like 2-3 hours talking, completely forgot about the party that we were attending. And at the end of the conversation, I'm like, you know that you're cool, man, you should really have kids together. And she looked at me, she's like, all right. She looked at me, she's like, okay. And we haven't kissed yet. Like, I barely knew who she was. I had no idea the work she's done. She was like a hot chick that just came around. Right. But she was, it was her New York, the incredible strength that, you know, that she had. And the day after we kissed, a week later, she moved in with me. 2 months later, I was in LA. 3 months later, she was pregnant. 5 months later, we bought a house. 6 months later, we got married. A year later, we had our daughter.
Oh, right. No kidding.
So that as I was getting ready to get married in LA, people were running bids against me, thinking that I was either there for the ride or how long we would have lasted. And
so tell me about how, give me a piece of advice on how to raise teenage girls.
Oh, learn. I mean, the good thing is that Deborah taught me so much about what women want, like, deserve, expect to be treated. I mean, I am a nice guy. I am a good mama's boy. I have manners. I've always loved every woman I've ever been with. Like, I remember all of them. And Deborah, obviously, is, you know, she's my number one. But in general, look at that.
Look at that.
We were younger.
You know, the funny thing is, when we took that picture, I was there dorking out with you, talking about food and wood-fired ovens. And I said, can I get a picture with you? And Debbie was like, Well, don't you want me in the picture too?
Okay. My little restaurant, man. I brought those lights. I'm going to use those lights in my garage. That's the only thing that I saved on my restaurant.
Oh, really?
Those old industrial lights are going to be in my garage.
Sure.
In a couple of months. Yeah. But no, that was it. I have to say, I consider myself extremely lucky because I've been extremely impulsive. And you know, it's easy to say, sure, I'm leaving Florence, following a chick to LA, not knowing what's around the corner. But then we got pregnant basically on the week of September 11th.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
The phone rang. We ended up a week on the couch watching the world fall apart. And we just got pregnant. My first daughter was born 9 months and 1 day from September 11th.
Wow.
July 12th. Yeah. So we got pregnant watching the news on that, those 3-4 days. What a life, man. What a life. If I think about, you know, how much has passed and how many things we've done.
Right.
It's crazy. Yeah,
so you went from after being married to have the first child. Did you have the second child before you moved back to New York?
Yeah. She started first grade in New York City. Oh, okay. So she was about 5 when we moved.
And what was the most difficult thing about being in New York? I think I saw one of your shows where you wanted to have a garden out in the back, but you know, the land is so
And
polluted, I mean, you know, it's really hard to build a garden there.
Absolutely impossible. I gave up right away. I also have a dog who claimed the garden even before I was able to claim the garden. So
right. The
whole idea of growing anything there just like vaporized. I always kept my garden clean, but you know, that poor animal really only had like a little stamp of grass where to, you know, take a piss sometimes. So that wasn't happening. No, the hardest part of New York, I would say 2 things. Well, first of all, as long as I'm with my family, I really kind of like, can be happy anywhere.
Sure.
So that was the strength. You know, we are very a very solid and tight family, so we always manage to find happiness wherever we are, as long as we're healthy. As far as New York, the things that I miss the most is the space, the fact that it's a city that develops in height, and the moment that I miss the sky and I don't see the sun running through the sky, I go absolutely crazy. And the second one is the lifestyle. In order to drink and eat the way that I like to do it, New York is a very expensive city. In New York, you can find produce because of the temperature, because of the land. New York City, as a city, comes the winter, it's expensive. Expensive to the point where I stopped purchasing certain things because I could not bring myself to spend 3 times the amount of money that I would spend in Italy for something just to have it on the one night. So one of the things that I stopped doing was to buy wine. I just stopped buying wine in New York City.
Wow.
You have to realize that the wine that we drink here with a sandwich at 12 noon,
that's
right?
Good.
Something that you just buy at the grocery store.
Right.
That's the bottle that you're paying $25.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So you're drinking in the evening after cooking for 3 hours, you decide to open a $30 bottle because you're like, okay, you know, it's a big dinner. That stuff that I drink before 2 p.m. in the evening, if I want to drink something, it has to carry it. And that's in the U.S. It's a $40, $50 bottle of wine. I damn refuse. I find it completely unfair. I mean, I get it. It's good wine is expensive. Just too expensive to enjoy the way that I'm used to. So I fell in love with American beer, which is something that is incredibly frustrating because there's not much American beer here in Italy. Big supermarkets carry, you know, the occasional Lagunitas or some Brooklyn brewery, but definitely not the craft IPAs that are, you know, definitely not Ballast Point from San Diego that is, you know, my absolutely favorite beer and I miss dearly. So I'm rediscovering wine because now all of a sudden, like, you know, what for the past 20 years had been really expensive wine, all of a sudden it's like supermarket. I come home every time with like 4 or 5 bottles. And my kids are like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm just building my own cellar. It's like, no, you're just dumping them on the floor. I'm like, well, welcome to my cellar.
you know, what's really funny. It's cheaper to drink wine over there than an orange Fanta.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that I found crazy in the United States is sometimes you find stores where Coca-Cola is cheaper than water.
Oh, wow.
And you're like, well, but wait, that's water plus sugar plus corn syrup plus marketing plus label. how is that cheaper?
Yeah,
that's very strange. One of the things that it's upsetting is that I live in the country, but my tap water sucks.
Oh no! Wow.
Yeah, that's it has a flavor and it has an odor as well. Nothing major, but definitely not something that you want to put in a glass on the side of your bed. I can make tea, I can make coffee out of it. I can cook with it, but I don't drink it, which is a bummer. So I don't know if it's a matter of installing a big filter, like a filter system for the house,
right,
or run for mayor and try to change the contracts one day and see who's going to give us the water for the next few years. I think I'll put a filter in.
Yeah, the filter will work, especially over there.
I bet better than politics. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. No kidding. Let's see what I was going to ask you. Now, in the house that you're in, is this the same house that you shot a couple episodes when you went up? Yes. I think when you got married.
Yeah.
So the big the Italian kitchen where you have the fireplace and you cook over the fire, is that the same house?
Oh, yes. Beautiful. Yes. Yeah.
Gorgeous house.
Really, really, really happy. It's you know, it is so strange now to be sleeping in my parents' bedroom, to walk to the room that used to be my bedroom when I was in my late teens, to say goodnight to my late teens daughters. Mm-hmm. It has happened a couple of times where, you know, I truly get out of bed to say, like, let's go say goodnight. And I take the walk and I'm like, damn, like, that's the walk my father took. Yeah. You know, that's, and it makes me feel good. The fact that this house is seeing once again, a moment that is generational. I only wish that my kids cared about this place as much as I do, but ultimately I don't think it's that important. I want them to have their life and eventually one day they'll appreciate. I mean, I was talking to my oldest one the other day and the only thing that she wants to do is be in the US. She wants to be in a dorm or in a sorority house. She wants to be in college and God bless her. Like I that's the American dream. Like, you know, who wants to take those 4 years away from kids? It's the best years of your life. But as we were talking, I'm like, well, you know, even if you don't like it here, okay, even if you want to be in America for the rest of your life, you need to realize that the moment that you get out of college and you've done your unpaid internship and you start paying off your college debt and you're looking for your first job and you get in a relationship and maybe pregnant and maybe you start looking for your house, the house you'll be looking will be your second house. Well, you already have a paid off set of keys. So go wherever you want. Risk it all, which is, I think, probably the best thing that I can do. You know, I it's the thing that I feel the most grateful. The reason that for me was very easy to say, you know what, I'll gamble it all. I'll chase this woman to LA. I'll see where it goes. Was the reassurance of knowing that coming back to this would have been the worst that could happen. You know, in health, obviously.
Yeah.
It's just a house. I mean, there's no work, there's no income, the life in the country and life in the farm in general, it's tough.
Yeah.
Like, you know, forget about the fact that it's quaint to see my fireplace. I collect my own wood. I don't buy it.
Right.
I have land. So I go down and I drag logs of wood with a rope in my house and I cut them and I axe them, I chainsaw them. I got blisters back on my hands. It's tough.
Yeah.
But it's paid off. It's here. The fireplace works. And the roof doesn't leak.
That's all.
Amen.
And good.
Amen.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question for you. And I want to turn our attention to cooking because our 7 subscribers, they write in us questions and 5 of those are anonymous. So bear with us here. One of the questions is I want to ask, and I'm excited about doing this is because in terms of cooking, if you have a pasta strainer, and the strainer is rusted on the bottom, should you throw it out or keep it?
My father would have spray painted it. no.
And I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, keep it. But your wife would have thrown it out, wouldn't she?
Absolutely. Without me seeing it. It has happened already.
Yes, I've done my homework. I've done my homework on you, sir.
Yes, I mean, look, the bottom of any pan is just the bottom of any pan. I'm not concerned with it. As far as pots and pans, really, the only time that I would suggest canning a pan is if you have some older Teflon that is getting scratched. Get rid of Teflon. That is just not good, especially if it's getting scratched. Teflon is just not good to have in a pan in general. But that's really it. I mean, look, like the other day, my mother, like, we don't have appliances, right? We left and gave to friends all the American Voltage appliances before we came to Italy. So we got nothing. I bought an immersion blender at the grocery store just so we have it. But if we want to make a cake or make some whipped cream, we don't have a whip. We don't have an electric mixer. So I called my mother and I'm like, can you come upstairs? I'll give you a slice of cake. But the kids are making, you know, whipped cream. Can you bring me the blender? She brought it in a shoebox with a string, with a rubber band taken from cleaning gloves. You know, the way that we recycle, like, right, rubber. Yeah. That's the mixer that I grew up with. I mean, that mixer is probably 35 years old. It works.
Yeah, sure.
Still there.
Right.
Nobody ever needed anything better. As long as it moves, you know, it's fine. That was very different from the way, aside from the work that I've done in the US, where every year, according to the job that I'm doing, they just kept on sending stuff to our house. So every year, the newest model, every year, the color that I preferred. Here is just like, once you buy it once, until the day that it breaks, like, yeah, squeeze it, make it work. Right. And I so do appreciate that. That was kind of like, that's a blender that I used in the very, very beginning of blenders when I was making cakes as a kid. So yeah, no, in general, I am very, I'm very cheap when it comes to, you know, the stuff that I keep around. Once you make the investment, keep it forever. Make sure that you do a good investment. If you're not comfortable with rust in your, you know, if your strainer, you can also toss it. It's just a strainer. It's not a cast iron pan that, you know, you don't like because the color is fading. You know, what was that, $15?
Right.
If you can afford it, you know, change it. You can do that. If not, fine.
Okay, well, let me throw this at you. So despite my best efforts, I would love to be a better cook. Now, Jimbo, he posts pictures all the time of this beautiful fire in his wood burning oven and anything. I'm not a good cook. So do I buy your book? Give me some steps on how to be a good cook. Cause there's a lot of guys in this country,
right,
single guys or whatever, that, you know, now COVID changed the game, but when we get back to when people are out and about, what are some of the steps that somebody could take to become a better cook?
Well, this is the thing. If you want to start
a better cook,
or a better cook. Yeah. So in general, the first approach is to go for a new recipe or go for a book, right? Look for something that inspires you. I would say the first thing is that never get impressed by what you see out there. The pictures there you see in any book have been worked on for hours and hours and hours.
Sure.
The food is cold. The food that you see in the picture most likely is already cold. Probably nobody ate it. Because it got covered in oil and been sitting in front of a camera or lights for a while. It has been done that way on purpose for you to drool. But it's very unlikely that if you're going, or if I'm going to cook for my family, one of those dishes is going to look the way that it looks in my book. All right. So first thing off, look at the picture, read the title of the recipe, get inspired. Don't get frustrated. Think about the things that you like, first of all. Never feel castrated by the fact that you might miss one or two ingredients. There's always room to jiggle. And that's, I think, the strength of my two cookbooks, the fact that I am not a chef by trade. So I'm always open to the interpretation of my dishes. I don't have a personal attachment to dishes. I did develop some of those recipes, but for the most part, they're interpretation of things that do exist in my country, my land. That's the way that I leave recipes that come from my area. Your grandmother, if we were neighbor, would do the same recipe, probably in a different way. It would probably taste slightly different. It would be slightly better, slightly less better. You would like it more because it's your grandmother. I would like my grandmother more because it would be... So don't get frustrated. Always start with simple ingredients. Never try to impress the people that you cook for. People are already impressed because you're trying to cook for them.
Great point.
The gesture, the time that you're putting and the effort is already a giving. That it's already an effort that you're doing.
Right.
Okay.
So, right.
You know, once you're at that, you're halfway through it. And if you know how to set the table and you remember the right flowers to buy, it almost doesn't matter what you cooked.
Right.
Okay. So when it goes to cooking, I always say minimal ingredients. So start with something that it's hard to mess it up. dishes of pasta are always the best. The simple dishes are always the best. Never overcook vegetables. Don't dive too deep in desserts. Desserts are the easiest category of food items to get frustrated with, because you cannot improvise. So unless you're a pastry chef and you're so used to deal with sugar, flour, eggs and percentages and dry ingredients versus wet ingredients, then you're golden. I personally hate it. One of the biggest exercises that I had to do when I started writing cookbooks and producing TV shows was to actually start measuring the things that I did. I don't measure, and you want to know something? I don't taste. I usually don't taste my food. I cook it, I serve it, I trust my instinct. There's been decades of cooking this stuff the same way. So, and very often I'm not really hungry until I sit down. I don't like the idea of tasting, and sitting down and not enjoying the surprise of something that I just cooked. So I love my first bite. There are certain things you have to taste and certain things that obviously you can skip. When it comes to my recipes, my two books are usually done in a good progression. The first book is a little easier than the second one. The first one is really my hardcore recipes, the stuff that I cook in and out with my eyes closed for my family constantly. The second book was an idea on how to adapt Tuscan cooking to life in the US. So there's some ingredient replacements. So there are some American recipes that I Tuscanized. One being my favorite American dish of all times, which is chowder, like clam chowder. To me, like, I wish I had a bathtub and I would just like jump into it. that's like me and clam chowder from the Northeast. Okay. Let's say things right. I also, and that's something that you will appreciate, when I arrived on my first year on the TV show, I wanted to make the Florentine steak. The Florentine steak is a 3-inch thick steak. Right. And it's unseasoned. Salt and pepper if you want, but even there is a school of people that say, no, you should season your meat afterwards. You gotta cook it unseasoned. Right. And other chefs like me that prefer the salty crust, I just cannot live without it. Like, I need that fat to have some saltiness flavor. So that's the thing, but that was the recipe. In production, you have to send the recipes to the TV station to approve it. It is, because if you come to Florence, the Fiorentina steak, that's how it's made. There's no marinating, there's no sauce, and there's not even much of a cooking. Serve. It has to be bloody. It has to be red. So figure or leave it. But that is how I grill stuff. And I arrived to the US convinced that the Tuscan grilling is just the pure way. Coal, salt, maybe pepper, that's it. It has to be about the meat. And then I started making friends. And then I started coming down to Austin. And then I started exploring the South. And like, you know, the pulled pork, the ribs, the stuff that cooks from, you know, 1 a.m. Like I went to, oh my gosh, what's her name? Oh God, I need to remember her name. A wonderful lady outside of Austin. The name will come. But she opens up on Saturday morning at 10. She cooks all night long. She opens Saturday morning at 10. And by 12, she's done. Like, stuff is gone. Right. And when we were there shooting, they were like, look, you know, we have this segment and we're going to do the Texas barbecue and we have to be there at 8:15. And I'm like, why? Like, that's when I have coffee. I cannot even breathe that kind of stuff early in the morning. They were like, look, that's how it's done here. And I'm like, all right, so let's go when things are done. So we went there like 5 a.m. Even if they started at 1. Like, I wanted to know what it was about. Is her name Glady? Gosh, I forgot.
It's on Netflix right now. There's a barbecue show, and she's the first episode.
She's
also a custodian at a high school, I believe.
Really? And, yes. Yeah, because she only works one day a week.
Correct.
And they only do Saturday.
Correct.
Yeah, but it's an amazing story because she lost her husband and she's in this tiny little Texas town and people come from miles to line up just like at Franklin Barbecue. She absolutely loves people. She does it. They hug her. And you know what she does after she hugs people? She's back to mopping and sweeping and clean. Yeah. She inspires us all just because of what she's doing.
And you know, her hands, when we were filming, I remember my director of photography pulled out his big camera and started taking a picture of her hands. And as I saw his work, he reminded me the hands of the farmers that I grew up with were, you know, yes, so she had pork fat under her nails or cure of the meat. The farmers here have mud and but the spirit is the same. It's that connection to the ingredient, that connection to the land, that connection that ultimately allows you to tell the story and bring it to people, right? I am nothing special. I'm just a conduit between people that are hungry and good ingredients that already exist. I am somebody that is able to put it together and also has, somewhat of a gift of wrapping it into a decent story that has some history to it and some flavor and some good wording that I've learned through the years. But in general, that is my work. My work is also to make sure that people do appreciate certain things in their simplicity. I am a big proponent of simple food and honest wine and honest ingredients. One of the things that brought me to my knees when I discovered, Southern barbecue, especially Texas barbecue, is the incredible devotion that has to go into it. People don't realize that, good smoking starts when you're going to sleep.
Right.
Like, we're starting to prepare your lunch by the time you're going to sleep, and we'll be there, or somebody will be there checking out the smoker from, 1 a.m., 12, midnight,
right,
until brunch time.
Yeah.
So, and that is a commitment that sometimes goes overlooked. It definitely does not go overlooked by Texans because they do know how it is. But, when the passerby, even at the airport, eats at the, that they have those locations now with the Austin airport, you eat the barbecue. Like, that meat is coming from the original restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, it's been cooking all night long. You're a passerby, you're getting a sandwich, but it's wonderful, and it's one of those moments that you see the connection that people make with ingredients and food the same way that we have with in regards of olive oil or wine or other ingredients.
Yeah. One thing I want to talk to you about really quick is the regionality of where you are in Italy. I mean, we're spoiled. Mm-hmm. We're very blessed and fortunate. I can go to Costco and get mozzarella di bufala. I can get Tipo 00 flour from Caputo delivered via Amazon, and my tomatoes come from, the hills around Vesuvius. I can get that here in Austin. But my friend who lives, Mike Quinn, who lives in another town, not Lecce anymore, but he's like, I can't even get Chianti wine where I am because it's so regional, right? And when I was there a couple years ago in Figline, they just opened the Iper Co-op, and it was so funny because we were on this organic farm, and the wife, Sylvia, she's the one that does the shopping for the agriturismo. He is the one that does everything for the organic farm, right? And I don't know, they probably had 40 hectares as well.
Okay.
But the dichotomy between both of them, it's like he did not want to go to that Iper Co-op to shop. He still wanted to go to the butcher. He still wanted to go to the baker. He still wanted to go to the place to get vegetables. But she was like, listen, I'm the one that does the shopping. I'm going to Iper Co-op.
That's one of the hardest things. Since I arrived in August, I was offered the ice cream parlor, the butcher shop, the bakery. There is this, we're going through a transition period where food has become a little bit of a commodity, right? It's just a necessary something that we just need to make it happen. So the big grocery store makes a sense because your life is busy, because in general, time is money, and you cannot bounce little by little. One of the things that I wanted to make sure that I didn't lose in the next year to come, and one of the reasons why I am here is exactly that. The fact that this is the very end of a generational moment where you still see these kind of artisans, and there's not that many young ones that are trying to take over. I don't even want to say their business. I'd rather say their knowledge. It's a certain form of art that eventually will disappear. I mean, it's very, very different to butcher one animal for one village or spending your day butchering animals that are getting frozen and shipped to Costco locations. So the approach is very, very different. There is a poetry in one sense and industrialization, mechanization on one side where you do the things on and on and on. I would love nothing more to be able to save them all and find the road in between. Because if there's anything that I've learned in the United States is that, yes, you can be as romantic as you want, but if you forget about commerce, buy a steer, butcher a steer. What happens if you don't sell it?
Yeah, throw the weight.
You're going to be losing your money. So one of the and that's why from the restaurant, I moved to the ATL, the idea of opening an hotel here. And I'm working with a group of bankers in Chicago to get the hotel. But at the same time, my end goal is shifting towards creating a place where, yes, you can come and eat. You can come and sleep if you really are tired. But in general, I'd rather teach you. I'd rather keep certain kind of traditions alive, making sure that if you're coming for 7 days of butchery, you can have a room. If you're coming for a lovely weekend with your wife and you know, expensive wines and good food, you can do that as well. If you want to come and work and live with us for 6 months, you can do that as well. In the meantime, I would like to see how I can put to work the things that I've learned in America. So the aspects of the editorial work that I've done, the TV work that I've done, the content creation work, because ultimately I know that my market is America. I invested 20 years in building a fan base there, and that's where my outlet is. The work that I'm doing here is on behalf of companies, on behalf of myself, but it's targeting the American customer. You know, that's my base. But I really care for certain things to stay alive. So, you know, hopefully I'll be able to make it happen. I have too many dreams, too many things that I want to do. So we'll see which one, you know, works out.
There was a really neat tradition when we were there. And we saw a cloth bag hanging from one of the olive trees near the entrance to our friend's Agriturismo. And I just sat there and I looked at him, I'm like, what's with the bag there? They said, that's the pane bag. Evidently, you know, you don't have to go to the bread maker. If you say, hey, I want my bread, just deliver it. And they come and they slip it in the bag that's hanging on the tree. Do they still do that?
Not here, because they just, you know, the problem with my town is that as quaint as it is, because of its proximity to the city, has been interpreted in the past few decades as your posh countryside, where it's good to have a house in the country, but that doesn't mean that your house is a farm.
Yeah.
Right? So our land was a farm. My great-great-grandfather purchased it in the beginning of the 19th century. So in the family, it's been only for like 3-4 generations. Most of the land around us is a little farmhouse, a few olive trees around it. But these are people that go to grocery shop down in the city at the HyperCoop. They live in maybe they're lawyers, doctors, architects. They're affluent people. Then in order to live that kind of life, you need to be in Figline, past Figline, in the country between Siena and Florence, in the country between Florence and Bologna, wherever you end up really isolated. Well, you have the mayor of town that also part-time at a butcher or a candlestick maker, like, you know, those villages where there is this a real deep connection between what happens in the village, the things that the people eat, the school where they go, the mayoral office. And one of the things that has happened, it's probably really the only thing that I took out of this COVID moment that we were going through. I thought I knew it, and this was kind of like the proof that I needed to know that I was right. I don't believe in the big city as a formula for the well-being of people. Big cities are not what people need. People need to know their doctors by name, their teachers by name, need to be able to wave to the mayor across the street, need to be involved in what happens in their every action that they make has to reflect on their own personal life. It's really hard to be a citizen of New York City because you're on your own. You're not really like you don't have that sense of connection. So I do believe that for our future, for the well-being, for the next generation, given that now we do have the right technologies, connectivity and technologies in general that help us make the most of it, small villages will be the secret for well-being. All you need is a good school, a good hospital, and good food, really, and decent people. So I would love to be the one that really helps my town position itself in that place. In order to do that, we need a hospital. Our hospital is, you know, has asbestos, so it's closed temporarily for the moment. But we do have the land. We have a good school system. We have a city hall that works. It's not that many people in our province. It's 14,000 people. It's like absolutely doable. Even Florence is not even 500,000 people. So there is this ability when you unplug from the gigantic city to see life from a different perspective, where you understand how you can benefit from a real connection to the land and to the people that work the land and to the people that keep the village going, that is a direct benefit to you. The bigger the city, the more isolated you end up, the more expensive the wine gets. One of the things that my wife wants me not to fall into is to become a hermit, because I mean, I like people, but I also like solitude. It doesn't bother me at all. I'm fine. If you drop me for a month here, I'm absolutely fine. I don't care. I don't care about any of you. But I love you all. You know what I mean? It's just like I don't suffer from the lack of it. She wants to feel international. So our dream is to fix this house, possibly do a show that brings us around Italy, around Europe. That's what we're discussing. And eventually, maybe one day, again, a Pied a Terre in New York City. Why not? I would love nothing more than have an excuse to come back. For the moment, I want to make sure that while I have the energy and the opportunity, I build the house the way that it needs to be built. And then we'll see. I would love to put a couple of robots working in the fields, like, you know, good stuff from, you know, Boston Dynamics kind of stuff.
I know two guys that could come over and paint your house.
There you go.
I'm painting on my own, man. I'm cheap.
Well, we're cheap too.
We'll work for vino.
Work for food, right?
Work for food. Work for good Italian food. Hey, and you know, honestly, when you go to Italy, I recommend, you know, you could do the big cities and, you know, not get out into the suburbs, but I'm living proof, and my wife and I are the same way. We rent a car and we get out into the hinterland.
I tell everybody. People ask me, can you send me the list off? I'm like, no, I mean, I can tell you where to go, but like, you got to make your own list by getting lost.
Now, that's how we found Figline. You know, that Figline is not a, you know, a hot tourist spot, but we found this agriturismo. And, you know, you just have to go and you get to know the people. And Italians are the most warmest people that you will ever meet. And they will open their hearts and tell you their stories and share with their recipes with you. And that's why I think you and I connected a number of years ago. And I thank you so much for that.
Please. Thank you. It's nice to connect, you know, with like-minded people. Makes me happy.
Let me just share on my end. I'm inspired today, because it's always good to hear, you know, you're thousands of miles away, yet you're very close. And I think you hit it on the head. It's about moderation and balance. Yes, let's keep our traditions, but I also sense and feel your inspiration toward others. And that's what I hope we never lose. That's what I try to tell my girls. Life is about balance and it's about moderation. And sometimes you're going to have good days, but sometimes it's going to be very sad. So we thank you very much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you for thinking of me. I mean, it's very nice to be here and finally have a, you know, house wired so I can feel still connected to the people that I've left on the other side of the pond. There are so many things and so many of you that I miss here. You know, I make fun of the situation saying I'm happier here. Truth is that I spent half of my life in the US. I still, you know, one of the funny things that we're really trying hard to do is to keep this house an American house. So all TV, all computers, all appliances, all the language is set up to English everywhere. We speak English in the house. We watch news in English. Also because I'm writing a new book and I really don't want to lose the wittiness of the language, which I adore. I think English is a fantastic language. You know, they're almost at the polar opposites. Italian is extremely romantic. We use words and words and words. And English is like so precise. You can just use that word in the right way and just like brings it to your knees. And I love the efficiency of it, like all things American, like the efficiency of the thing. But it makes me happy that that you thought of me and that we can connect even by being, 7 hours apart, jet lagging. So...
Yeah. So the big question for me as we end this, I haven't seen the wood-fired oven yet. When are you going to build one of those?
It's not in this room. We need to do an episode from the fireplace.
Do you have
one? I actually I actually made ribs last night. So yeah, no. The fireplace is like the first thing that I lit off in August. I was barbecuing inside the house. I don't care.
800 degrees and you're firing it up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I did the Thanksgiving meal this year, the first time in the wood-fired oven.
No, nice.
Yeah.
So, indoor or outdoor?
Outdoor. This one, the last one in my last house with the outside kitchen that I built mm-hmm. it brick by brick. So a four.
I remember it. Yeah, I remember it.
So the new one is, first of all, I wanted to make it mobile because if we sell this house, that puppy's coming with you. Right. So I built a steel base for it and welded it and then built a platform. And then I got from, I think, I don't know what the company name is, but it's outside of Milan. And it's a company that makes fornos in kits. And you can just tilt it all together. It's about 1,100 pounds when it got delivered. But then you build it up on whatever you're going to, you know, rest it on. And then you cover it with the insulation and then you stucco around it. So that's what I did this time.
Why you have to do in Italy. You cannot build a kitchen outdoor because the moment that you start building volumes that are cemented to the ground, you got to pay taxes.
Really?
But if you build it portable,
yeah,
it's not considered an added volume to your house. So that's what I did for the show because we were running late. Right. So I'm like, well, what if we build it in a way that we can say a forklift could move it? So we're like, well, that's not a volume.
Right.
I'm like, okay, that's how we do it. It's still there.
That's exactly what
I did. It's been 10 years. It's still there.
Exactly. I didn't
build it. But if I need to move it, tomorrow will be gone.
Absolutely. A pallet jack is going to lift mine.
I'll drag it if I have to. Okay.
Well, you've been a big inspiration to me for many of years. And can't begin to thank you enough for being on the Jimbo and Jeff podcast today. And seriously, best of luck with all of the renovations that you're about to do.
Keep following. There's so much happening. And I really hope that we can sell again a TV show with Deborah because we have good ideas, good material. And this time would really be like a Green Acres situation because we really want to get into the farm and we want to get to know the producers around us. And given that people have not traveled this past year, I think that there is also the room and the need for a certain kind of content that is uplifting, but also inspirational and discovery and traveling without moving. It's a little important. So we'll try to do our best.
Wait. Did I hear you say Green Acres?
Yeah. And here's a dorky piece of knowledge why I know this, but what was the brand of tractor that they had?
Oh, wait a minute.
Come on.
International?
No.
It's not international?
No, you won't.
That was Zsa Zsa Gabor, wasn't it?
That was, but the brand was a Hoyt Clagwell.
Oh, Jim.
Oh, you're such a nerd.
Why I know that.
Wow.
Yeah, real nerd stuff.
No, don't do that.
No, but you know the truth is that's how the show was presented to the TV executives over 10 years ago. Oh, wow. The problem is that it was 2008, 2009, right? People were losing homes everywhere.
Right.
Oh. And nobody felt that the story of the actress that leaves Hollywood and moves to the villa in Tuscany to fix the villa in Tuscany was fair to people that were actually struggling. So we stripped off the whole Gigi component, the Zsa Zsa Gabor component.
Right.
We're like, right, let's go after food. Let's go after the simple things, you know, the love story and the ingredients. And it turned into a TV show. But that was really the very beginning. Now we're trying to do the opposite. We're trying to reclaim that because at least we had the show before. So people know that we can deliver good content. So instead of having that half hour where you have the four recipes in it, you have a little bit more discovery, maybe a little bit more guests, maybe like two recipes instead of four. So it's not like cook, 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 but it's about meeting the producers and having conversations that are a little calmer than, you know, those 23 minutes of pounding recipes, you know, the way that Scripps Networks wanted their product to be. But
telling stories.
I learned a lot. So at least I know that next show will be closer to the way that I see things.
Gabriele Corcos, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, guys. It was
really
a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
The Jimbo and Jeff Show. The Jimbo and Jeff Show.